Welcome to the second of our pair of podcasts focused on Equally Well, supported by Sport England. My name is Andrew Boyd. I'm GP in South London, and I'm the physical activity and lifestyle clinical champion for the RCGP. In the first of the podcasts, we had a great conversation with Chris Lynch, who's a lived experience advisor for Equally Well, and Emma Bailey from the Centre for Mental Health, who manages the Equally Well programme, finding out a bit about the Equally Well programme and what it's like to navigate the NHS as someone with a long-term mental health problem. Today, I'm joined by Jonathan Bickford, who's a GP in Oxford and a visiting GP to mental health settings, and he's also the RCGP rep for Equally Well.
Hello.
And Zoe Williams, who's a GP in South London as well, and my partner in crime at the RCGP Physical Activity and Lifestyle Clinical Priority.
Hi there.
So just to reiterate, if you haven't listened to the first part of the podcast, do please do that, because we'll be referencing it in this. So, Jonathan, as we talked about in the first podcast, there's this shocking gap, really, in terms of mortality and morbidity between the physical, between people with severe mental illness, SMI, compared to the general population. And I guess I'd like to know where that comes from and what we can do about it.
Yeah. So as we set out earlier, that the life expectancy is significantly reduced between 15 or even up to 25 years, is quoted in the literature, as is an average age of death of our patients at 56, which is remarkable and shocking, as we established. And I would also add that our patients experience poor physical health at a younger age as well. So as we know, for any of us living with a long-term condition, it is a great change to our lives and a great challenge. And then to combine that with a history of mental illness, I think is even more complex and difficult. So our patients experience the ill physical health that everyone is: cardiometabolic disease, cardiovascular disease, and cancer. Diabetes in particular, where I work in mental health settings where we can check everyone's blood sugar because they are inpatients, our prevalence of diabetes is 21-22%, and these are young people. They're in their 20s and 30s, and I'd contrast that to my own practice, where the prevalence of diabetes is 4.4%, which is an older population. So you see the dramatic difference. And other cardiovascular risk factors, hyperlipidemia, hypertension, and then chest disease and cancers as a consequence of smoking. So the physical health risk factors are fairly simple. They are obesity and smoking, which I might add is the two risk factors that we are all addressing as GPs with our patients.
And it's those excess risk factors that predominantly lead to the excess mortality that we're seeing. And how good are we in both primary and secondary care at picking up the risk factors in this group?
I would say we are not good enough, although there's been great progress, and I'm delighted with the profile now that physical health of our patients who have mental illness is now receiving, particularly through Equally Well. So when I go and work in a mental health setting, I must say it has been, I think I'm going to use it, shocking to a degree to see that that the mental health professionals, who are remarkably skilled and knowledgeable about addressing mental health, do not have the same, or perhaps even any, knowledge regarding physical health. And Chris talks about his own experience of the fragmentation of care, this division between mental health and physical health. This is historical, but the legacy is very much there today. In the hospitals in which I work, they are designed without a provision for physical health. You know, the way the rooms are, you know, there isn't a peak flow meter. To get scales in sometimes has been a challenge. The electronic records we use are not fit for purpose for physical health. I'm fortunate that West London have bought EMIS, so I can address physical health. But the principal thing is the doctors and nurses not receiving, in my view, an adequate education in physical health. My examples might be that a patient will have their risk factors checked, for example, blood tests and things in secondary care, and that is supported with commissioning sequence, but they're not knowing what to do with them and how to interpret them. Just a couple of weeks ago, I identified a patient with an HbA1c of 52, and that's been there since last year. Nobody realized or recognized that as being the definition of diabetes. I think the RCC psych should include some physical health, because there is very little at the moment. My example would be that when a quarter to a fifth of your patients are diabetic, and the word diabetes is not mentioned once in core or specialist training, that's just not good enough. And it's not particularly difficult, just the diagnosis of diabetes or the diagnosis of hypertension. And therefore, coming back to GPs, we should be aware that our secondary care colleagues do lack some knowledge around physical health. So we should be aware of that for our patients' sake when we see them as GPs in primary care settings.
Absolutely, because I guess I sort of imagine that when patients of mine have gone into secondary care with mental health problems, I guess I'd perhaps in a rather optimistic way thought that a lot of their physical health problems would also be addressed, conversations around smoking, conversations around physical activity. But it sounds like from your experience in both settings, that's not necessarily happening.
I really don't want to be unfair, because people are endeavouring to do their best, and there has been great progress. But I might give another example, going around and seeing drug charts with physical health drugs, and the psychiatrist's uncertainty about what to do with them, they tend to remain there. Antihistamines prescribed for hay fever 2 or 3 years ago, and just crossing these off. This reflects for some people their lack of confidence around physical health.
So
it is lacking to a degree, in my view.
And it's not about knocking colleagues at all. It's about recognizing that there are these gaps and there are these conversations that aren't happening. And just as Chris talked about in the first podcast, this siloing of physical and mental health care, and the lack of communication between the teams, that ultimately the person who suffers is the person who we're trying to help, which is not where we should be. Thank you, Jonathan. So next, I'm going to just ask you, Zoe, as a regular GP, what's your experience of trying to support people with long-standing mental health problems with regards to their physical health?
Yeah, well, obviously, I, like you, Andrew, I'm all about lifestyle medicine, all about supporting patients and empowering them to take care of their own physical health as and when they can, around smoking, nutrition, physical activity, sleep, etc. But clearly, when it comes to patients who have long-term mental health problems, there are lots of challenges around that. It just is more difficult. And I've kind of broken it down into three different areas. There are the patient factors, the GP factors, and then maybe, you know, the wider sort of factors around secondary care and services. So for patients, you know, tackling smoking, for example, we know that 60% of patients who have severe mental illness smoke. So it's much higher than the average. And imagine if you're somebody who is struggling with severe mental health, you're in a highly stressed state a lot of the time. Giving up smoking, which for many people might be their one crutch, it's almost impossible. So immediately that sort of highlights that for some groups of people, behaviour change is extremely difficult, and, you know, for some maybe almost impossible. And then there's the medications as well. They can make people feel more drowsy, less motivated, and we know about the links between antipsychotics and weight gain as well, so that's making it even more challenging. And, you know, these people often have difficult lives because of their illness. They may be less likely to be in employment, may have financial difficulties, may have housing issues, may have problems with substances as well. So immediately for the person, living more healthily is much more challenging. And I think the GP factors, I know I certainly as a GP, I don't see these patients that often. I work in an area, a very deprived area, in South London, and it's rare, actually, except for when patients are very well, they'll come and see us. I don't feel that we see them that often, so that's a huge barrier. And I know, you know, we do have the QAF marker, the mental health care plan, so once a year we should be seeing all these patients, they're on our register. But I know when I've been looking after that QAF marker, coming up towards QAF deadline, actually even ringing them personally or sending letters, often they have difficult lives. The last thing they want to do is come and see the GP so that you can tick your boxes. You know, that's not their priority at that moment in time. So I think recognising that as GPs, we often have very limited access and we don't see these patients and have a good relationship with them necessarily. I think they do have a much closer relationship with their mental health teams. So it's kind of quite disturbing really to hear, Jonathan, that I agree with you, you know, our mental health teams are doing the best that they can with what they've got. But clearly when it comes to physical health, they're not looking after these patients and we're not either. And that's really worrying, yeah. Especially thinking about 20 and 30 year olds with undiagnosed type 2 diabetes. We know that undiagnosed type 2 diabetes left for 10 years. That's when you're looking at blindness, you're looking at kidney failure. You know, the consequences of that are terrible. So to hear that there are many of our patients out there who we're not seeing as GPs, who are having HbA1cs coming in at 52 and that not being picked up, you know, clearly the time has come for us to be working much more closely in combination. And then the third pivot of this really is around services and secondary care. And I think the letters that we receive often from mental health teams, they can be very comprehensive and very detailed. And maybe as GPs, we sometimes don't actually have the capacity to read through them with a fine tooth comb like we should. And again, I mean, I guess I've never really noticed that physical health doesn't get mentioned in there. It's never really flagged in my mind that this is being missed, that this is a huge gap. So I think we definitely need to readdress how that communication is going on, and then wider services as well. So in my local borough in Southwark, over the past few years, I've been involved in commissioning tier three weight management services. And unfortunately, one of the exclusion criteria for that service is people with severe mental health problems that are not currently well managed. And that's because if you look at the data, then actually, because we do group sessions, then often for those patients, working in a group setting isn't the best place for them and it isn't necessarily best for the other people. So clearly there are lots of gaps, and it's great that we're having this conversation, because this is where it starts, by talking about it, seeing where the gaps are, addressing the issues. It's just good that we're starting to talk about it.
It does seem ironic that if we'd, for a patient that we knew about who was in second, you know, who'd had diabetes identified in secondary care, it's our absolute bread and butter as GPs to be able to manage that. Mm. And actually, as Zoe mentioned, particularly when the quaff year is looming, because that's almost quite a significant part of our income as GPs, we're scurrying around looking for those patients who are often the ones who have changed phone numbers, changed addresses because of chaotic, difficult lives. And actually having that conversation, that two-way conversation, could really make all the difference. And I think that's very much, it's about conversations and about communication that Equally Well is kind of hinging on. So we mentioned about the annual health checks for people with severe mental illness. Any thoughts about that, Jonathan?
You mentioned quaff, and when quaff first came about for patients on the mental health register, that did include screening for diabetes and for lipids, and then that was when quaff was diluted under, you know, for the reasons that we well know, that was dropped. The idea of commissioning that we continue to check our patients' parameters, but that there was a bit of evidence to say that we're not doing that. So although now NHS England has set out that the commissioners should be addressing this for primary care, and so there is local commissioning, certainly in my area, where there is now, we are commissioned to do the annual physical health check. So it's basically the equivalent of an NHS health check for any patient who is on the mental health register. So annually we would be doing those things to pick up, for example, undiagnosed diabetes. You mentioned atypical antipsychotics, and what I try to encourage is to focus on the bits that we know about, for which there is evidence, and that is the cardiovascular risk factors, the obesity, the smoking. And I do observe, I think we become a little bit sometimes distracted by the role of antipsychotic medication. It is not necessarily, of course, straightforward to use, but it is the best we have got. More untreated psychosis has a significantly higher mortality than treated psychosis. And certainly in secondary care, and as us as GPs, we are asked to do this monitoring and antipsychotics, for example, the ECGs. And I urge my colleagues to get back to looking at the things that we know that will make a difference. A cardiologist and I have had a look at the evidence around the screening for the cardiovascular problems associated with atypical antipsychotics, and it is very weak. There isn't really anything to say that it makes any difference. And I raise that because there, in my view, there is also a lack of research on that applies to our patients, because they may even be excluded from it. I must say it was disappointing to hear that patients with mental illness can even be asked not to attend the weight reduction groups. And I understand what's going on there, but you know, that concerns me to a degree.
Absolutely. So excluded from research, yes. So there's a lack of evidence, yeah. Excluded from certain programs for understandable reasons, but again, it's making a marginalised population even more marginalised.
And more vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. So of course, Equally Well, as we said, you know, sets out to try and address some of these problems. And, you know, GPs are kind of, they're busy, but they're pragmatists, and, you know, their reason for being there is to try and help their patients. So what sort of things, perhaps we'll start with Zoe, what sort of things do you think GPs can do, and how is the RCGP, and particularly the clinical priority around physical activity and lifestyle, how can we help those GPs to make sure that they're getting those patients who are going to benefit the most from being, for example, more physically active into the surgeries and make some positive behaviour change?
I think, I mean, this could sound quite daunting, couldn't it? I mean, a 10-minute consultation with somebody who probably has a lot of social issues, psychological issues and physical health issues. I think the first thing to think about is that, you know, this can be a positive conversation with a patient who we're often having quite negative conversations with. This can be a real opportunity to sort of build that relationship with the patient by talking about something positive that they might want to do, and really basing the conversation around them, using motivational interviewing techniques and saying, what could you do that would make your life better and healthier? And remembering that there's a lot of support around you. So as a GP, you're not on your own to help support these patients with their physical health journey. So making sure that you're linking in with your practice team. Maybe there's a practice nurse who has a special interest in this area. Maybe there are other patient groups in and around you. And then having a chat with the local authority and the CCG, and just really trying to be aware of what is available locally that you can signpost that person to. With the emergence of social prescribing, a lot of CCGs now will have a social prescribing lead who's a GP. So just getting that person's email address, they're likely to be a fountain of knowledge. So I think really, you know, think of it as a positive thing that we can do with our patients, basing the consultation around them and their agenda, and just having an awareness of what support is available for you and your patients in the local area to get them moving, more active, healthier and happier.
Jonathan, anything to add to that?
We've talked about the division between mental and physical health and just trying to combine the two. And as GPs, we are the original integrated practitioner. We can do it all. And Chris mentioned how good he felt that his physical health was raised. He felt cared for. And, you know, mental health improves a good physical health, and vice versa. So combining the two is a key thing that we do. Remember that it is commissioned, and it may just take a tiny little tweak as guiding somebody to where that the weight reduction services are, or the smoking cessation services. Maybe not.
I think we are the last of the generalists, and certainly what and we can't perhaps do everything, but we can at least start that conversation.
Yeah.
And both Emma and Chris talked about in the first part how it was that kind of giving permission, that starting the conversation going, that interest in something just beyond, you know, what dose of this you're on, what dose of that you're on. Chris talked about how important having continuity of care with the same GP, or perhaps with the same couple of GPs, that really made all the difference. You don't have to go through everything again and again every time, starting at square one. And I think the kind of advent of social prescribing really is really important. And just knowing perhaps a few things that are in your area that you know you can safely signpost patients to. Again, Chris talked about the what he derived particular benefit from over years is peer-to-peer support. So perhaps knowing just about one or two things that you can directly signpost to, and then if you have got access, and of course all of us should have access to a social prescriber fairly soon, making sure that that person has the expertise and the knowledge of what other kind of echelons of support are around there for patients.
And I guess just in the meantime, whilst waiting for that, a couple of things that are available to most GPs locally that, you know, are very accepting and very inclusive would be Walking for Health. You can usually find one of those in your local area, and Parkrun as well. And as the RCGP, we have actually collaborated with Parkrun. So if you're a GP practice, you can register as a Parkrun practice, and, you know, why not use the opportunity to get all the patients and some of the staff involved in Parkrun as well.
Great. So, I mean, I think we'll close now. But finally, Jonathan, just it sounds like the key things are for us to communicate better with our patients, to communicate better with the secondary care teams that are looking after our patients with mental health problems. And it's never that difficult to pick up the phone. And my experience is that whenever I do that, it's always a positive experience speaking to a secondary care consultant. But looking kind of a few years down the line, where would you hope that together with the Equally Well approach, we would have got to in the context of that physical mental health kind of?
The aspiration is that we recognize undiagnosed disease earlier, that we are continue to be commissioned. And if I was to provide my wish list, there would be more commissioning. For example, we are commissioned as GPs to go to nursing home settings or elderly care settings. But remember, our patients, if they're dying in their 50s and 60s, they have the diseases of older people in their 30s and 40s. It is my view that we should be commissioned to specifically to address the physical health at a younger age. We should endeavour to do more research and gather more data for our patients. And the key thing of all is education. We all, both as GPs and our colleagues in mental health, have a greater degree of education, so they know what to do.
Great. Well, thank you both very, very much for joining me today. And I hope that's been interesting for you to listen to. A reminder that because the RCGP is a founder member of Equally Well UK, you can access their resources, share your ideas, get peer-to-peer support as professionals through the website, which is equallywell.co.uk. Thank you very much.